Welcome to another episode of Hear Her Sports, a female athlete podcast for all things, well, female athlete. I am your host, Elizabeth Emery. Each episode shares a conversation I've had with an absolutely amazing female athlete or women in sport. My guest and I always cover so much ground, from training, nutrition, and psychology to science research, mental health, and coaching. We have an exciting episode today because pro cyclist Haley Simmons is here to talk about the recent safety issues and subsequent discussions at Tour Féminine des Pyrénées. As these things generally are, the problems at Tour des Pyrénées are representative of similar issues beyond that one race. Haley also clarifies that there were good things about the race and how it was organized. So it wasn't all big problems, which was how it had appeared, to me anyway. Haley has been a full-time professional cyclist since 2016. She's a time trialist extraordinaire, having won 2 elite British time trial titles and 17 cycling time trial national titles. She also holds 3 British time trial records at 10, 25, and 50 miles, and was the first woman to break the 50-minute barrier for the 25-mile time trial. Internationally, Haley has represented Great Britain at 5 Road Cycling World Championships and 3 European Championships. She's won a bronze in the time trial at the 2018 Commonwealth Games and another bronze in the time trial at the 2019 European Games. She has also represented Great Britain at 2 eSports World Championships and at the inaugural UCI Gravel World Championships in October 2022. Haley races on the road for AWOL O'Shea Continental Team and represents Movistar Team Gravel Squad Off-Road. She has finished on the podium at 2 UCI Gravel World Series races and has qualified for the 2023 UCI Gravel World Championships coming up soon. Haley has also appeared as co-commentator and studio pundit for several high-level cycling events, including World Championships, European Championships, Ride London, Commonwealth Games, and La Course. As you might remember, Haley was on the show in episode 137. I highly recommend that one because she told us about her recent iliac surgery, which was totally fascinating, her beginnings in gravel racing pretty much as soon as she got back to the bike post-surgery, and about the Cyclist Alliance mentorship program, which she has been involved with since early days of that successful program. For years, Haley has been an outspoken advocate for the growth of women's cycling and equality within the sport, which is, of course, why we love her at Hear Her Sports, and makes her a perfect person to have on the show for us to discover more from her insider's view of Tour des Pyrénées, but also to find out what she believes are the issues most important in women's cycling at the moment, as riders are about to start the second year of the new version of the Women's Tour de France. You can follow the racing along with Haley because she'll be tweeting from the account Le Tour Data when it starts on July 23rd. I am so pleased to have Haley here as a guest on the podcast, so let us welcome her. You know, I have a ton of stuff I want to ask you.
Yep.
And talk about in regard to some recent events in women's cycling. It's such a privilege to have you here. I appreciate you taking the time and being willing to join me today. Thank you.
No problem.
So, you know, for listeners who haven't heard the story yet, can you get them up to speed about what happened at the CIC Tour Féminine International des Pyrénées that took place on June 9th and June 10th? And also maybe explain that, you know, what the race is, that it is sort of a high level event.
Yeah, so it's, it was scheduled to be a 3-day women's stage race, UCI 2.1 level. So one of the higher levels of kind of women's racing. So just under the kind of World Tour level of race. And it was the second edition of the race. So the first edition took place last kind of autumn, so it was a slightly different time of year. But yeah, this edition was due to take place and started on the 9th of June as a 3-day race. So I'd actually been out to the area with some teammates in early May to look at some of the routes, and it was beautiful, beautiful routes and a really challenging race for the women, which is a really nice thing to see because quite often, you know, you don't see that many women's races with mountaintop finishes. And, you know, it's in an area of France that's kind of really iconic for the Tour de France. You know, Tour de France Femme is going to be racing in the area at the end of July because it's very close to the Tourmalet, which is, you know, the kind of major climb on one of the Tour de France Femme routes. So it was also a really good opportunity for teams who would be racing Tour de France Femme to kind of visit the area, potentially combine it with a training camp, and look at some of the Tour de France Femme routes as well. So the race started on Friday the 9th, and stage one was based around Lourdes. Sorry, my French pronunciation is not great, so that's probably not how a French person would say it. But yeah, it was quite clear from relatively early on in the stage that maybe the road closures were not kind of at the level that maybe is expected in kind of high level UCI racing, or even lower level UCI racing, to be honest. You know, cars were kind of managing to get onto bits of the route, actually still moving as opposed to just being kind of pulled over at the sides of the roads. And then around probably 60 kilometers into stage one, and stage one was 130-ish kilometers in total, so kind of around about halfway, we kind of got a message over the radio that the race was going to be paused. So the organization actually paused the race, and we were told that the reason was because there'd been a crash earlier on that the race ambulance had to attend, and that the ambulance hadn't yet managed to kind of catch back up to the back of the race, and that is a requirement that there's, you know, an ambulance on hand. So we kind of paused for a little bit to wait for that. And whilst we were paused, some of the riders kind of towards the front of the peloton were having a discussion about the fact that there had been some traffic on the course and that maybe it wasn't as safe as it should be. So there was kind of an agreement between riders that we'd ride in a neutralized manner for the next kind of 10 kilometers and just, you know, see if things changed, because you know, that some of the riders had had a bit of a chat with the organizer and said, look, you know, we're a bit concerned about this. So we kind of agreed that we'd ride neutralized for 10k, and actually that next 10k was a lot better. That there weren't any cars on the course and the closures seemed a lot better. And then we kind of started racing again, and actually in the latter parts of that stage it again became clear that there wasn't as much control over the road closures and traffic on the roads as there should have been. And then a lot of people have seen some of the footage that was circulated, because actually one thing that was good about the race is we had very good media coverage, very good kind of TV coverage. It was all being shown live, which is great for the profile of the sport. But as a result, obviously, it was very evident that the safety was maybe not up to par. And in the final 3 kilometers of the stage, which was a circuit around the town centre, there were quite a few incidents with, you know, a bus on the route, a car on the route, people crossing the road, and various other things that made it not a particularly safe finish. So after the end of stage one, there was a lot of discussion amongst riders and the kind of safety commission and the rider representative kind of for the race that you know, has the kind of job of taking any safety concerns to the race organisation. And it was agreed that stage two, the first 25 kilometres would be neutralised in order to kind of give the safety motorbikes and the organisation kind of an opportunity to prove that they had better control over stage two. And that first 25 kilometres, again, ran a lot more smoothly. The race was then deneutralised and we started racing. And then again, kind of, you know, within the next 10, 15 kilometres, there were more incidents. So the peloton stopped. We kind of stopped ourselves at about 43K and kind of had a big discussion in the middle of this road about what the solution was and whether people felt safe and whether they wanted to continue racing. The organisation wouldn't agree to another neutralisation. And so the peloton then
en masse kind of agreed that we would ride neutralized to the bottom of the final climb and then race the climb, which, you know, a kind of group agreement amongst the racers is always a very difficult thing. And, you know, that kind of brings its own complications. And then, yeah, after the end of that stage, there were yet more discussions. There were team votes on whether we thought that stage three should be raced or not. And after quite a lot of debate and discussion, stage three ended up being cancelled. So, the race was kind of concluded after two stages, neither of which, I suppose, were raced fully and in a kind of normal fashion.
What was your experience like during the race?
So during stage one, I was aware of there being cars on the course, and I've done a lot of UCI racing at various different levels, and you do often see cars that have maybe managed to get onto the course, but they're often pulled over to the side, and there'll be a marshal with a motorbike and with whistles, and they'll be kind of standing, making sure the cars are kind of stationary. You also normally get race marshals, static marshals around different points of courses, you know, standing on, for example, traffic islands in the middle of the road, blowing whistles and waving flags to kind of indicate that there's some sort of obstacle that the peloton should be aware of. It was quite evident that there were not as many of these static marshals as you would normally expect, because there were quite a few obstacles that weren't being kind of flagged as being there. And there were cars that were not just on the course, but actually still moving. So they'd managed to find a way onto the race route and either weren't aware that they shouldn't still be driving or didn't care that they shouldn't still be driving. And so they were actually moving kind of towards the peloton.
That sounds scary.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And it's, you know, it's not like we were on like a fully open kind of road with, you know, masses and masses of moving cars, but there were enough to be concerned about.
Well, it also means that you have to continue to like be aware of what's happening around you in a way that it sounds like it would sort of inhibit racing.
Yeah, definitely. It makes it more difficult because you're not just concerned about maybe what other riders in the bunch are doing and when attacks might be going and things like that, but you're having to then expend additional mental energy, which obviously becomes quite difficult when you're fatigued from racing. You know, thinking about, well, is there a side street there that a car could potentially, you know, get onto the course via? You know, is there a traffic island coming up that I can't see because I've got, you know, another, you know, I've got 100 other girls around me in various places? You know, is somebody going to suddenly notice a traffic island, move away from it really last minute and, you know, potentially cause a crash? So it's extra kind of mental energy, which can be very difficult to find during certain points of a race, especially when it's hot. You're deep into a race, you've had to work quite hard. So yeah, it was quite difficult to deal with. And the other thing that was difficult, particularly in stage one actually, was after we'd had the kind of stop at 60K and when we were waiting for the ambulance and there'd been the discussion with the organisation, I think some riders had obviously said, like, you know, there don't seem to be enough like motorbikes kind of coming through to get to other points of the course to signal either to stand at junctions or to signal road furniture, etc. And so I think the organisation, you know, maybe had a word with the kind of motorbike marshals to say, you know, you need to be kind of getting ahead of the bunch and making sure that you're kind of in place. And what happened then was, so normally, you know, the race will pass a point where there are marshals. Once everyone's passed, the marshals will then get on their motorbikes and they'll drive to the next point that they need to be at. And as they're driving through the peloton, what normally happens is, you know, they sound their horns. The peloton then kind of, when there's, as quickly as there's an opportunity, the peloton will all move towards the right-hand side of the road, let the motorbikes through on the left, you know, and then once the two, three, four motorbikes, however many there are, have moved through, the peloton will kind of, you know, resume the road positioning that they wish to take. But what actually was happening was it almost felt as though the motorbikes were too desperate to move through because they'd been told by the organization, like, you need to make sure you're at the next place. And so they were sounding their horns, but then almost trying to drive through the peloton before the peloton had really had chance to move. And actually one of my teammates got kind of clipped by one of these race motorbikes and came down with a couple of other girls. So actually one of the race motorbikes ended up causing a crash within the peloton by not giving riders an opportunity to move out of the way before they tried to drive through. And that was also something that I was aware of before my teammate was hit. There was I actually had a near miss with something very similar where, you know, I was on the left-hand side, a motorbike sounded its horn. I kind of looked to my right to see if there was space for me to move across. And before I'd really had chance to move, the motorbike was kind of almost up level with me. And I had to really kind of squeeze into a gap between the motorbike and other riders to try and move out of the way. So that was, kind of surprising and a little bit worrying.
Who are the marshals?
It varies from race to race. And okay. I don't know the answer to that in this case. So in the UK, it's normally an organization called the National Escort Group, NEG. You know, there's kind of, I think race organizers will often, pay the NEG to provide a certain number of, you know, race motos and things like that to, you know, ensure the safety of a race. I don't actually know really the ins and outs of that. I believe in France, and again, I'm not 100% sure because it's not something I've ever been involved in, but I believe in France that you can pay the gendarmerie, so the French police, to do that service, but I don't know any details of that. I'm pretty sure that it was a different organization kind of taking charge of the safety at Tour de Pyrenees. It wasn't the gendarmerie that were, you know, on the motorbikes and doing the road closures. And I'm not sure whether that is part of what caused the issue, the fact that it was someone else and not the gendarmerie. But I don't have any experience of kind of trying to organise the safety around a race. So I don't know, but it varies from country to country.
This leads to my next question, which is, you know, like, these rolling road closures isn't something new or unique. You know, it's not particular to this race and it can be done safely. So what went wrong in this case?
Yeah, so you normally have a rolling road closure. So unless you've got a race that's just, you know, repeated laps around one route. So for example, you know, the third stage of the Ride London race, which is the only women's world tour race in the UK this year. So that the third stage of that race was held on a circuit in central London. And so the entire circuit, which was around 11 kilometers, was just completely closed, you know, for the duration of the race. That's obviously easier to control because it just remains closed. But most races, obviously, if it's either an A to B or it's a much longer circuit or something like that, you have a rolling road closure. So you have what's called the race bubble. And there's often in like the team briefings or in the tech guide or the manager's meeting, they talk you through the race bubble and they say, you know, if you're outside of the race convoy, so behind all of the team cars and the ambulance and things like that, then you're effectively racing on an open road. So you have to be aware that even though you might still be be allowed to finish and get a time, you're no longer within the safety of the race bubble. So, you have to almost treat it as being a completely open road. But normally within the race bubble, so between the lead motorbikes, the lead car, and the back of the race convoy, you should be within a rolling road closure. And yeah, and normally what happens is you have enough vehicles towards the front of the race who are driving ahead of the peloton or ahead of the lead rider to kind of almost signal that the race is approaching. You have the kind of static marshals who will move from location to location to secure, you know, key junctions or things like that on the route. And then obviously you have like the riders and then the team cars behind and things like that. And so that's normally meant to be a kind of secure, you know, couple of kilometers worth of space, I suppose. Yeah. And it is the norm. It's really commonplace. So I suppose in my opinion, the thing that went wrong on this occasion was there weren't enough bodies on kind of motorbikes, for example, moving ahead of the race and getting to key locations with enough time to make sure that junctions were secured or cars were moved off the race route or key impediments on the route had a body on them with a whistle to kind of signal that they were there and that riders should, you know, not crash into them, for example. So I think it was possibly just not enough people to provide all of the kind of safety and security, which then meant that the people who were doing that job were kind of rushed and frantic and therefore potentially not doing as good a job as they would otherwise have been able to do.
It also sounds like maybe there wasn't enough instruction about what that job entails, because it's not an easy job. I mean, you're dealing with cars that really want to go where they want to go. And, you know, you're having to stand up and say, sorry, you got to wait for whatever length of time it is. And it's, you know, probably not super short. And so you're dealing with a lot of belligerent people, possibly. So it does require some instruction and you know, some understanding of what's actually happening. And it sounded like that was not there either.
And again, like, I don't know the details of who it was that were these marshals that were providing the safety. So, you know, in my opinion, having done a lot of races and come across a lot of drivers who, you know, obviously want to go about their days and don't want to be held up by a bike race coming through, some people are potentially only going to respect the police in whatever country you happen to be in, which is why it probably is really quite effective if you have the gendarmerie providing the road closures, for example, because at the end of the day, it's not that likely that somebody's going to say to a policeman, you know, you can't force me to stop here. I'm going to keep moving anyway, because, you know that there's potential repercussions if you disobey the police. I think probably having police closures is more effective. I don't know the organization who it was who were kind of in charge. I heard, and I don't know how true this is, so, you know, this is not a kind of fact because I don't know, but I heard from someone that the race organization had outsourced the kind of safety provision to a separate kind of company or business, or, you know, they basically, the organization didn't necessarily arrange all of the kind of safety aspect themselves. They kind of outsourced it. So that could have been the source of the problem, because I suppose if you outsourced it to somebody who, or a company who have put in place road closures before, but maybe not for, like, you know, a high level UCI bike race, then they might not be aware of just how many bodies are required and how difficult the logistics can be in terms of getting ahead of the race once the race has gone past. So potentially it was just an oversight and a bit of a mistake that the organization thought, well, actually we have a lot of other things that we need to organize for this race, because, you know, organizing a bike race is not an easy thing. There's a lot of different things that have to come together. So potentially the organization said, you know what, we have a lot of other things that we need to do and maybe not as many people as we could use. So we'll focus on one aspect of it and we'll, you know, hire a company to do another aspect of it. And potentially that's where it fell down. But I don't know for sure, because that's just something that I heard and not a fact that I know.
It's, you know, I know we're talking about sort of this, and when I say we, I don't mean just you and me, but, you know, sort of the discussion about this race has really been focusing quite a bit on the cars on the course, which certainly is a huge safety factor. But as you mentioned, there was the issue with the ambulance. There was the issue about some of the sort of dangerous road furniture not being marked well enough. And there were also, you know, like the sprint lines at the finishes and also during the intermediate sprints and GPMs, those seem not to be marked as well. So, I mean, it just seems like the entire organization was not that great. And I know there's also been discussion that we shouldn't be blaming everything on the organizer. However, you know, from an outside perspective, I'll have to say that, you know, I want to blame them. This is not something, they're not having to reinvent the wheel. Like, this has been done before. And I'm just surprised at sort of how many places they fell down at such a high level race. I mean, we're not talking about sort of local schmokel race.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose what I would say actually is that, in my opinion, a lot of the race routes were marked really well. So there were arrows everywhere showing you where the race was going. And they were there for the whole week before the race, because a few members of my team traveled direct from another UCI race in the Alps, a one-day race, across to the Tour of the Pyrenees. And so we were kind of in the area from the Monday night, and the race started on the Friday. And as soon as we arrived on the Monday, you could see all the arrows up for the race routes. So the race route was actually signed really well. And also the GPX files were available really, really early as well. So that was dealt with really well. And also the, maybe not so much for the sprints actually, because I didn't necessarily notice loads and loads of signs marking sprints. However, the GPMs were all marked pretty well. There were signs saying, like, you know, 1 kilometer left of the climb, 500 meters left of the climb, things like that. So,
that's good to hear.
Yeah. So that was actually, those things were actually done really well. And for example, one thing that can be not a problem, but difficult in some races is, you know, you have a neutral at the start of the stage and then the stage proper starts. And sometimes it's actually really difficult to see the sign that says this is kilometer zero. So, you know, if you're somebody who wants to reset their Garmin so that you've got an accurate kind of kilometer count for sprint points and GPM points and things like that, like you potentially rely on being able to see the kilometer zero sign. And that's something else that was, you know, actually very evident in the Pyrenees. It was really obvious, like, okay, this is kilometer zero. So actually a lot of that stuff was done really well. And the communication from one of the organizers was also really, really good, because I contacted her back in May when I knew that I'd be doing a training camp in that area to say, you know, are there routes for the courses so that, you know, I can potentially go and have a look at parts of them. And she replied really, really quickly and you know, pointed me in the direction of where the GPX files were and things like that. So there were actually a lot of things that were done really well. And I don't know whether maybe the fact that obviously the safety was not how it should have been, people are then criticizing other aspects of the race, which actually, right, I think were done much better than a lot of other races.
Interesting.
And the TV coverage as well. Like, you know, it's one thing that's really important for women's racing
is visibility, because if you don't have the visibility, you're not going to attract the big sponsors. There's not going to be as much money in the sport. And, you know, that makes it difficult for everyone. So the fact that a really, like, there was really good coverage organized was amazing. Like, you know, that's something that, well, you know, people, anyone following women's cycling at the moment might be, you know, might almost be surprised that the Giro d'Italia is going ahead, because, you know, even a few days ago, there were very strong rumors that it would be cancelled last minute due to, you know, the TV coverage requirements not having been met. And you know, so there were problems even a few days ago, and the race is due to start any day now. So, you know, the fact that there was TV coverage organised for the Tour of the Pyrenees was incredible. But obviously that did mean that the kind of shortcomings in terms of the safety were visible to everyone.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Is this going to make organizers reluctant to have such good TV coverage?
Yeah, potentially, which is obviously, you know, that's a problem.
And yeah.
One thing that I'm really sad about the whole thing is the fact that, you know, this race is potentially now unlikely to appear on the calendar again because of the fact that the race wasn't finished. You know, there are then potentially going to be issues with sponsors or companies or organizations who put money into the race. Obviously, certain parts of the organization themselves are very unhappy about unhappy with the peloton about what happened, and, you know, have already suggested that the race will now disappear, which in my opinion is extremely sad, because as I said right at the start, like, it had the potential to be an incredible race until last year when Tour de France Femme kind of came back. The women have not had so many opportunities to do these kind of big Tour de France climbs and do like mountainous stage races with summit finishes. It's still something that's kind of not that common on the women's UCI race calendar. And so, the Tour of the Pyrenees offered something different and something unique, I guess. And it was a race that I was really looking forward to doing, especially having ridden some of the routes back in May. And so, yeah, one of the things that's made me the most kind of sad about the whole thing is the fact that how things worked out means that we might now lose what could have been a really amazing race. And, you know, that's obviously not the result that anybody wanted.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I don't want to spread rumors, but it's interesting that you mentioned that possibly they had sort of outsourced the safety. And it seems like if that were the case, that's an easy fix. You know, you just sort of get that company up to speed about what they need to do. And obviously they learned a lot this race, or not do that next time. And it would serve them to just say, okay, this is what we did. It was, you know, we messed up or it didn't work out. And that's an easy fix. And then you have it on the calendar again. I think maybe sort of this lack of transparency of what actually happened is somewhat concerning.
Yeah, but I think sometimes you see pride with certain sure. parts of organizations, and actually I don't know everybody who was involved with the organization, and the people that I'd communicated with back in May are not the same people who have come out in the press and made, you know, slightly hurtful remarks regarding what happened and about the women who were racing. And obviously those people who made those remarks in the press, it feels like, you know, their nose is out of joint kind of thing by what happened. And it almost sounds as though like their pride has been hurt and they don't necessarily want to admit that they potentially made a mistake. And it's that kind of attitude that is then the problem, because if they're like, well, these women act like, you know, they acted like spoiled girls, we didn't do anything wrong, they need to, you know, be less whiny or whatever it was that was said, you know, if that person who made those comments is a key person in the organization, it sounds as though their pride has been hurt to the point where they don't want to fix the mistake. They want to almost just pretend as though they didn't make a mistake and kind of not bother in the future.
Mm-hmm. My biggest objection to that sort of line of comments, which was actually was the race organizer, Pascal Baudron, and I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, is it fell under the category of women should be grateful to have whatever we give them.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was, that is really troubling.
Yeah. And this is, again, this is one thing, like there were other people involved in the race organizations who certainly don't have that opinion. There were women involved in the race organization who I communicated with, who I have a very good opinion of, and actually fight quite a lot for women's rights within the sport, and would certainly not come out with that kind of opinion. But obviously, yeah, you know, there are a race organization is a big thing. You've got quite a lot of different people involved, and yeah. So obviously, he came out with those comments, which is definitely very troubling because, why should we be grateful to be allowed to race? We should have the same level of security and respect and professionalism as any men's race. And as a region, that region sees the Tour de France every year, so they obviously know how to put on a bike race. You know, they're used to bike racing. It's not new for them.
Today's episode is sponsored by Endura Athletic. Endura Athletic is on a mission to create ethically sourced athletic apparel that empowers and supports athletic women's bodies. Rather than asking women to fit into clothes, Endura Athletic apparel fits clothes to women, making space for powerful lats, broad shoulders, and strong legs. Through artfully designed, sweat-tested, and well-fitting apparel, women can tackle their workouts while feeling confident in their physique, whatever shape it takes. I am a big fan of Endura sports bras. They are made to fit athletic bodies of all sizes. Mine is super comfortable and cute. I love the shape of the neckline and the quality material it is made out of. You can order your own Endura sports bra and find out more at EnduraAthletic.com or on this episode's show notes page at HearHerSports.com.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listener survey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
And now let's get back to professional cyclist Haley Simmons and find out what are the important issues in women's cycling at the moment. So let's sort of expand this discussion about, like, beyond this particular race, because, you know, there are these issues of safety, which are hugely important, but there's a lot of stuff underneath that. You know, like, I'm thinking about other issues in women's cycling, like race distances, prize money, salaries, you know, the team makeup and support. And you talked about the professionalism and, you know, also the race calendar, which you mentioned as well. Like, what of those things are super important? And what do you think, you know, what happened at this race, how that's going to impact sort of this other category of all these issues?
It's such a wide thing. I mean, yeah, we need our races to be safe. Like, that's a big thing, especially with you know, what we've seen in the Tour of Switzerland, in the men's Tour of Switzerland. Racing's getting faster, the equipment's getting better, the organisations want to have exciting racing. And, you know, potentially that does mean that sometimes racing incidents occur and, you know, nobody wants bad crashes to happen. It's just, you know, it's not anything anyone wants. And to be fair, the UCI and the CPA have identified these problems and they are kind of stepping up to try and address them. So hopefully we will see kind of, you know, some sort of consideration of race routes and finishes and different descents and things like that. But, you know, so safety is being recognized. That's obviously a really key issue. With the women's side, I think a lot of it does come down to money, and it's difficult it's sometimes difficult to come up with a kind of order in which things should be done, I suppose, because you need race coverage to attract sponsors, you need the sponsors to put the money in, but then you also need money to kind of secure the TV coverage, and there's almost a chicken and egg type thing, and somebody just needs to potentially just take a risk and you know, take the first step, I suppose. It would be nice to have, you know, a wider race calendar, a more varied race calendar for the women, and to see some of the races that exist for the men have women's equivalents. But again, that would actually be a problem with the way women's racing currently is, because you see the men's World Tour teams and they've got rosters of, you know, 30 odd riders, for example, whereas a lot of the women's World Tour teams will actually only have maybe 12, 14, 15 riders. So as soon as you have a couple of riders come down with an illness or have an injury, then suddenly actually the top teams can't run a double program. So you don't actually have then enough women to kind of support all of the races that are then on the calendar. And again, it's a financial thing, because potentially if the teams had more money to invest, they could employ more riders. And so suddenly you've got rosters of 20 women. So then you can send two teams of six to two separate races that are happening at the same time, even if you have illness and injuries within your squads. And again, I think something that I spoke to you about the last time we chatted is in terms of like the number of women's World Tour squads that there are, there will be 15 next year. Those 15 are the only 15 teams that are required to pay salaries. Below that at continental level, some teams will be paying some form of salaries, but there's no requirement. So a lot of teams probably won't be. And that then creates the gulf between the teams. So even at Tour de France Femmes, you know, you might have the 15 World Tour teams, but then you're going to have extra teams that aren't World Tour. So you're going to have, you know, in that race, you're going to have some riders who are, you know, the highest paid female riders in the world. And then you're potentially going to have riders that aren't paid and maybe have to have a full-time job alongside it. And you're going to have teams with way smaller budgets who can't afford the resources, the staff, the extra support that riders on the World Tour teams will be getting. And so you've got this like massive gulf between different levels of teams, and that can make it really difficult.
I always get so frustrated talking about the lack of money in women's sports. I mean, you know, everybody's talking about how, you know, women's sports are coming up and it's a great investment and blah, blah, blah. And then when push comes to shove, there isn't still enough money basically in women's sports.
Yeah, because, you know, even though a lot of the top riders on the World Tour teams, you know, they are paid enough that they don't need to do anything else. They can just ride their bikes and focus on their cycling career. But there are riders on other teams who, even if they're earning a salary, you know, they might be earning €1,000 a month. Now, that's not enough for them to not do anything else or not have support from somewhere else. Like, if, you know, if they have support from parents or partners or whatever, then they could still be a full-time athlete. But, you know, you can't support yourself in terms of like rent or a mortgage plus food plus everything else from €1,000 a month. So they might say, oh yeah, I'm a professional cyclist, and actually they might be extremely happy with the salary they're getting, but it's almost due to a kind of, it's kind of almost a bad representation of the way the sport is, that, you know, they're actually feeling extremely grateful to be paid €1,000 a month, and that's not really,
we're back to that grateful business again.
Almost teams that are kind of giving that salary often would almost give the impression of, well, you know, you should be really grateful to get €1,000 a month, when there are lots of teams that don't pay their riders.
Right.
It's like, well, actually, should I? Because can I actually live off that? No. So do I need to potentially find another job? Yes. Is my team going to be happy with the fact that I'm also working a part-time job, a full-time job, etc.? Probably not. It's not a sustainable situation.
Right. So on the commentary, before we talked, I listened to every single second of the coverage of the Pyrenees race. And one of the things that came up was that the growth of women's cycling is too fast. I happen to not agree with this, but I'd love to hear what you say.
Yeah, I disagree as well. And I haven't actually listened to the commentary. I haven't watched the race back, but I've read several articles recently with people saying the growth of women's cycling is too quick, and, you know, it needs to slow down a bit. And I disagree as well. I think that it's been too long that it's been accepted that, you know, the women aren't paid, or the women are riding less challenging courses than the men, or, you know, shorter distances or anything like that. And we need to be given the opportunity to prove that our races are just as exciting. And I don't really see why we have to justify that we also deserve to be paid, you know, at the same level as the men or anything like that. I just think that, you know, the history of the sport is obviously more towards the male side, but because it's been operating for so long successfully for the men, I don't understand necessarily why it can't just kind of almost step up and offer the same for the women.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think that the commentary about women's cycling needs to slow down, it basically implies that the women are not good enough yet, which I find troubling.
I think a lot of the women are good enough, but I think the fact that very few teams or companies will invest the same money in the women as they do in the men is the problem. Because if there were as many women paid the same amount as the men, then you would see more professionalism, potentially better performances, because more women would have the opportunity to train full time, race full time. They'd get more race experience because there would be more racing on the calendar. They'd have more support. They'd have, you know, the performance coaches, the nutritionists, the analysts, all the kind of resources that are piled into the men for the Tour de France, for example, where, you know, the team staff will know every inch of the road. They'll talk to the teams about exactly where the wind's going to come from, where the splits are going to be, and things like that. You might see that in the top women's teams, but you certainly don't see it across all of them, because the teams don't have the money to pay the high-level staff. So you don't get that kind of level of input and analysis on the women's side yet, certainly not throughout the teams. And it all comes down to money, and it's really, it sounds like a broken record, but that really is it. You know, if somebody was prepared to invest the same level of money, then you'll see the same level of professionalism And it's not that it's growing too fast. It's that maybe, like, yeah, you need the influx of money, because if you have the influx of money, then the growth can be a lot quicker anyway, because you've got more people doing their jobs, just not just the riders, the staff as well, at the same level as the men. And then, yeah, you'll see the same kind of racing and levels of ability across the board, I think.
Well, this is a great segue to talking about women's race coverage. And part of my reason for wanting to talk about this is I was watching the men's Giro, the 3-week Grand Tour, at the same time that I was watching the Tour of Spain, the women's Tour of Spain. And the coverage was so different. You know, the men's had, you know, and I watch on GCN, the men had that breakaway before and after. They have, you know, four people, experts, former riders, analysts talking about the race again before and after the race. They have great commentators during the race. And the Tour of Spain, which they were calling a grand tour, even though it was 7 days, which I found completely offensive, you know, there was none of that same sort of hoopla that the men's coverage was getting. And to me, this is a huge problem. Like, I figure if I am more interested in watching the men's racing than the women's racing, something is wrong, because I am, you know, like, probably the best audience for the women's coverage.
Yeah. So I was having a discussion about some of these kind of women's grand tours recently. And so it's like different organizations as well, and obviously different times of year. So this was the first like Vuelta, like women's Tour of Spain, for the women this year. And I kind of was saying, oh, you know, it's obviously at a completely different time of year. And I hadn't realized, probably because of, you know, how recent I suppose I am to cycling versus the history of the sport in general, the men's Vuelta used to be actually at the same time of year as when the women's Vuelta was this year. And it's only in kind of more recent cycling history that the men's Vuelta has moved to be after the tour, supposedly so that, like, you know, if riders were actually aiming for the Tour de France and then something happened, they would kind of have another shot at like a grand tour by then going for the Vuelta a España. But I think the organization who put on the Vuelta also put on the women's Vuelta. And obviously with the Tour de France and Tour de France Femme, they're both ASO, and the Giro at the moment are completely different organizations. So the men's Giro is one organization and the women's Giro Don is a different organization. So some of it comes down to like the organizations, I think, and, you know, the resources that they put into the race.
I should inject here that the women's Tour of Spain, the racing was amazing. I mean, it was just fantastic.
Yeah.
Totally fantastic.
Yeah, it was.
But it's not a grand tour because it was only 7 days. I mean, there's a lot of stuff about being a grand tour that has to do with how long it is, about what happens over that, you know, like the drama happens over that time.
Though it is effectively one of the longer stage races.
Sure.
We just don't have stage races of that length. You know,
you've
got the Giro, which I don't know whether it's 10 days this year, but it's previously been 10 days. Tour de France Femme is 8 days. So it, you know, it does actually match. I'm not saying that this is right, but it does match up with the length of the tours of, you know, the other grand tours for women. And again, I feel that the women's races should be longer. I'm not saying that they should go directly from the current 7, 8, 10 days all the way up to 21, because I think that is too big a jump to happen in one go. And again, it's something that's not going to be possible until you have a vaster number of teams having more resources and having more money, because otherwise you know, you can't expect the lower level of teams who are in those races to be able to operate over a 3-week tour with the level of funding that they've currently got. But as you said, you kind of need the race coverage in order to attract the sponsors, to then attract more money, to then enable the teams to support their riders, or to have the facilities to have staff and riders performing over, you know, a longer race. So it's such a kind of chicken and egg like cycle, and somebody at some point it needs to be broken, and it's just how, like, that first step being taken to interject, and it's going to take somebody brave or a brave company to do it, I think.
I agree. And I think that's why I object to the huge difference between the two races that I was mentioning, men and women, is because GCN, and sorry to put them on the spot, GCN could be that brave person.
Yeah.
They could have the breakaway before the Vuelta, the women's Vuelta, before and after the race. They could do that. You know, like, they're not reliant on, like, all this other stuff that we're talking about in terms of, you know, growing the sport in a manageable way. They could just decide, okay, we're going to invest the money in having this great coverage of the Tour of Spain.
Yeah, they could. And I don't know enough about, obviously the kind of the way that the decisions are being made. And I think one restriction that you do get is actually like the footage that they're getting, for example.
That's so interesting. So,
you know, they could say, well, actually, we're going to have great commentary, great coverage of the Vuelta for the women. However, if the race organization themselves are not providing a helicopter, TV motorbikes, et cetera, then actually GCN or any other broadcaster don't have the footage with which to provide live commentary of the whole race.
But they could still have that commentary before and after the race.
Yeah, they could still have the thing before and after, because they could have, you know, previews of the routes. They could discuss what happened the previous days. Yeah, so they could still have that. But the in-race visibility is more down to the organization.
Sure.
So, for example, I did some work last summer for Tour de France Femme for NTT, who provide a lot of data. Now, I did kind of some experience work with them as well, looking at the men's tour before I worked on Tour de France Femme. And so in order to get their data, with which they provide a lot of the information, they rely on the TV motorbikes, because all of the riders' bikes have like transponders and chips and everything. However, you only get the kind of signals from those sent back to, you know, whatever it is, wherever they gather all the information. All of the signals from the riders are kind of sent back via actually the TV motos. So for the men's tour, because there's TV coverage for the whole thing, from the very start, you can basically pinpoint every single rider in the race. You can say, like, I guess, like, what speed they're doing, where they are, what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. For the women, there was only live coverage being provided by the organization for the Tour de France Femme last year for the final 2.5 hours of each stage. So actually, that also made it really difficult working on the race, because you couldn't accurately pinpoint every single rider in the race until the TV coverage started. Because the signals from the transponders on the bikes weren't being transmitted back, because you relied on the TV motos and their presence.
Yeah.
But, you know, the decision to broadcast the final 2.5 hours was something that's obviously made by the race organization.
Right.
So that, you know, that's one thing that kind of needs to change, I suppose. The organization has to make the decision, you know what, we're going to broadcast 100%. You know, we're going to pay the extra money to make sure the whole thing is broadcast. And then that enables, I guess, the growth of, like, the media coverage in other countries, because it's, you know, GCN will just be picking it up from whoever it is at Tour de France, at the Giro, at whatever, whichever TV media company that's local, they'll just be picking up their feed.
Yeah, I mean, and they talk about it a lot. I think what my objection is with the comparison I was making between the women's Vuelta and the men's Giro is sort of the perception of the two races.
Yeah.
And especially since they're choosing to call the women's Vuelta a grand tour, even though it's only 7 days, they are then saying, okay, these two things are equal, and we're giving this huge drama, huge production, stars and whistles, blah, 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 for the men, and they're doing, like, comparatively nothing for the women. And so it sets up this, like, really bad comparison.
Yeah, and some organizations have tried to kind of address that in the past. Like, back in 2019, Vox Women did a lot around the Giro. I think it was the Giro Rosa then, because it's obviously gone through a couple of name changes. But they did a couple of things around the Giro Rosa then, where, like, every day they would have, like, Rebecca Charlton plus a guest, and I did it for a few days, doing some of the, like, voiceover commentary on the stage. But they would also do some, you know, some discussion beforehand. They'd do a little bit of analysis after. So not to, you know, not quite to the extent of the breakaway, for example, but, you know, they did that to a certain extent. But again, it relies on somebody providing the money for that to be done, because, sure. Yeah, until somebody's like, you know what, we will pay you to do all the recordings, to hire the location in which you're doing the recordings, to get all the, you know, the infrastructure in place to kind of do this, and we will broadcast it, until you have that, then yeah. You're not going to see the amount of coverage that you should do. And I agree, like, it is a bit insulting that you get so much around the three grand tours for the men, and, you know, there's not the same visibility for the women.
Yeah. Well, what can we expect from the upcoming Tour de France Femme avec Zwift?
It's a different kind of route this year. And I think it's all going to come down to the final weekend, because you've got the really mountainous stage as the penultimate stage, and then you've got time trial as the final stage. SD Works have been incredibly dominant as a team this season. So they're going to be the team that everyone's going to have to try and challenge. But obviously you've got Annemiek van Vleuten racing for Movistar, defending champion, her final year of racing. She's going to want to win. But yeah, I think it's going to be a really exciting race. And I'm hoping that the coverage will be good, and that it will provide a really good platform for the women, and, you know, enable more sponsors to become attracted to the women's side of the sport and see what is on offer, and to invest a bit more in our side of the sport.
That would be nice. Are you going to be involved at all? Are you racing?
I'm not racing. Unfortunately, the team that I'm on are not one of the teams racing. I would love to race it. It's something that, in fact, I was saying the other day, I was having a discussion with someone about things that I would still very much like to do over the next couple of years of my career, and I would love to ride Tour de France Femme. Yeah, like, just being able to say that you've done that is incredible. But I will be doing some of the work for NTT again. So great. I will be kind of in charge of the Le Tour Data Twitter feed during the women's race.
Well, that would be fun and interesting.
So yeah, hopefully I'll be able to provide some insights and kind of get a bit of interest up about the women's race.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being willing to talk about all this. It's been really fun. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
A big thank you to Haley for taking time from her racing schedule to be on Hear Her Sports and to fill us in on what went on at the Tour Féminine des Pyrénées. Be sure to follow the Tour de France Femme avec Zwift on Twitter through the account Le Tour Data. It'll be Haley posting. Stage 1 is on July 23rd, and there are 8 stages total. As always, a huge thanks to all of you for listening. It really is true that it's you, the listeners, and your comments and notes that make producing the show worthwhile. It's fantastic to talk to all the incredible women that I do, but it's bringing the conversations to you and having their stories heard that is important. So I'm grateful you are here, and be sure to tell your friends about the podcast. Let me know what you're thinking and wondering about. Email elizabeth@hearhersports.com or connect through socials at hearhersports. There's also a contact page right on the website. In the episode, Haley references a lot of stuff, like the Tour de France Femme avec Zwift, Giro Donne, and a comment about spoiled children. You can find out more about the things that we talked about in the show notes at hearhersports.com. Hear Her Sports is a proud member of Evergreen Podcasts. For more information or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. One of my favorite shows on the network is Women's Running Stories. It's a podcast featuring first-person stories about running told by the women who experienced them. In particular, I'd suggest you check out the current episode, which features pro triathlete Sika Henry, sharing her stories about running the Comrades Ultra Marathon in South Africa. I just love the quote right at the top of the episode, "Something wonderful is going to happen." And until next time, bye-bye.
Hey there, my name is Michael Laminato, and this is Pit Pass F1, a brand new podcast that'll take you closer to the action of the world's most prestigious motorsport. From Monaco to Miami and Australia to Azerbaijan, Pit Pass F1 is on the ground and has you covered. Esteemed F1 journalists Julianne Serasoli and Chris Medland will take you inside the sport every round. They'll keep you up to date with the latest news breaking in Formula One and the most influential views shaping the world of Grand Prix racing. Every Friday, we'll be bringing you a track guide and race preview, and Chris and Drew will be in your feed every morning from Saturday through to Monday to keep you up to date on all the day's action on and off the track. So if you want to be in the know on the latest in Formula One, subscribe wherever you get your favourite podcasts and visit us at evergreenpodcasts.com. Pit Pass F1, a brand new show for Evergreen Podcasts.